this is David. Check out my new podcast, Certainly Dubious, with my very good friend Mark Diaz, where two longtime friends take on the intriguing and the bizarre with opposing viewpoints. We invite you to listen and pick a side. Mark, the open-minded, and David, the skeptic. Join us and pick a side. This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Thank you to all the supporters of the podcast. If you too would like an ad-free experience of the podcast, you can become a supporter at patreon.com/gracefulatheist. If you are in the middle of doubt, deconstruction, and the dark night of the soul, you do not have to do it alone. Join our private Facebook group, Deconversion Anonymous, and become a part of the community. You can find us at facebook.com/groups/deconversion. My guest today is Liam. Liam and I have been friends and colleagues for well over a decade now. And Liam and I have had a couple of conversations throughout our lives, some back when I was still a Christian and some after my deconversion. But I have always respected Liam's faith. Liam is a Quaker or a member of the Religious Society of Friends. He is specifically a part of the British Liberal branch. And as you're going to hear, this is quite different from the evangelical experience. After having listened to the edit, it's clear to me that Liam probably felt the weight of representing British Liberal Quakerism to a potentially atheist but deconverted, deconstructed audience. And I just want to take that off of his shoulders. What I was really after and what I think we got was his story and what Quakerism means to him. And I think that comes through with Flying Colors. But I just want to let Liam off the hook here immediately that he doesn't have to represent that solely on his own. I respect Liam so much, and I think that you will benefit from hearing his story. Here is Liam. Liam, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Liam, we've been friends and colleagues at a couple of different jobs over the years. It's going on more than a decade and a half or so at this point, so it's been a long time. I absolutely consider you a friend. I care about you as a human being. I'm legitimately curious about your life story. I know tiny little bits and pieces. I feel like there's so much that I don't know. The theme of the podcast is people's religious experiences, both the good and the bad. And so we're going to start with that. Like, what was it like growing up for you?
Yeah, I suppose, sort of going on from what you're saying, it's been an interesting sort of, the two of us working together has been interesting in terms of our kind of respective religious kind of journeys. And I think, you know, I found your experiences really interesting. And yeah, and I suppose when you're talking about your life story, it's kind of not like hard to know where to start, because you've got the context of your family and you've also got the context of your own sort of memory. Mm-hmm. So I suppose it started with my grandfather was a Quaker on my mother's side, and he was a cartographer, and he was a conscientious objector in the Second World War.
Okay.
And at the time, what they would do is kind of take you and sort of try and train you for occupations at home that weren't fighting. And so, I mean, despite being a trained cartographer, he became a porter, and that's where he met my grandmother.
Okay.
Yeah, and hence my mother came around, and she's been a lifelong Quaker herself. And I suppose that's how I grew up, with my mother as a Quaker, mm-hmm. and my father was a staunch atheist and kind of member of the peace movement in Leeds, where I grew up.
Okay.
So there was a lot of kind of overlap there, because peace is quite a central tenet of Quakerism. And, you know, my father was a member of, I don't know whether CND I don't know whether there's CND in North America.
Let's state the obvious, that there are going to be major differences between the UK and the US that we might highlight just for fun here. One that I'll mention immediately is World War II had a huge impact on the US, but I think nothing like the UK. That was country defining for the UK.
completely. I remember my grandmother talking about sitting on a hill and looking out while Coventry Cathedral burnt. Mm. And I can't even imagine what that must have been like for her, because she would have been young at the time.
Yeah.
I think that the scars of the Second World War are kind of everywhere. You know, like the street that I live on, it's all terraced housing, and there are gaps where it's more modern. And that's where the, you know, bombers used to offload any bombs that they hadn't dropped on important places, on Norwich and, you know, on the way back. So, I think you're right. It was, you know, and being a conscientious objector at that time, I've no idea what that would have been like in North America, but certainly it was frowned upon, shall we say.
Yes.
So he was very brave to have done it. He was a man of complete conviction, and and I think maybe we'll come on to this. He was much more of the very traditional Christian Quaker background, so he would have been much more Bible reading and much more literal his interpretation of Christianity. So my mother grew up in that background, and she did a lot of sort of, she was a Quaker as a teenager. She went to a Quaker school, and then she met my father, and then it's kind of where I enter the story.
Yeah.
So I have some very slight memories of meeting when I was one or maybe I went two or three times before I was 13. And I should say, like, meeting is where Quakers meet. It refers to the building, and it also refers to the event. So I went to meeting a few times, but I don't really remember it. And then when my parents got divorced, and as part of that, my mum moved from Leeds down to Norwich, which was about 200 miles. And it must have made sense at the time, but basically I went to a residential Quaker camp for a week. It was my first time away from home properly. And it was this week away. And she dropped me off. And then she moved us wholehearted down south.
Okay.
And when she picked me up, I didn't go home. I went down to my new...
To a new house.
Thing. Yeah. And I hated that week. Absolutely hated it. And I remember having a friend there we hated it together.
Okay.
We kept each other going by our hatred of it. And we swore we weren't going to go back. And I went home. And then something in me changed when I reflected on it. And I think there have been moments in my life where I felt that something's nudged me.
Okay.
And I think you can easily explain it away. But to me, it felt like I was nudged. And I reflected on my experience and felt very strongly that it was me, that I didn't enjoy that week because of me, not because of anything else that occurred there.
Okay.
So I decided to give it another go. And I would say that's when, so I went back a second time, and that's when I think my kind of Quaker journey sort of started.
And how old were you?
I was 13 for the first time I went. I would have been 14 the second. And it was this incredibly profound moment of I found my people, that the sense of belonging that is very, very hard to explain to people who haven't maybe experienced it. School at the time was very, I wouldn't have said it was tough, but friendships were very much like you were expecting some to be teased if you messed up. You wouldn't want to make a mistake.
Yeah.
It was advantageous to be sporty, which I wasn't. There was lots of ways where I felt like I was always treading on eggshells. I had friends, but I don't know that I was ever felt totally comfortable in those friendships. I often felt like if I messed up, they would ridicule me. And
Like you have to perform to be something.
Yeah. They were still good friends, but it was almost part of the friendship was this sense of you had to knock off sides of your personality.
Yeah.
And then I went and I found it very hard to accept to begin with that there was nothing I could do that would make these people ridicule me, or there was nothing I could do that would stop these people accepting me. And I absolutely found my people. Like I had this amazing group of friends who I stayed with from sort of 14 to, would have been about 21, 22. And then because the experience was so good and because I ended up moving to rural Norfolk, it sort of became, school kind of splits at 16. Quite often schools would only go up to 16. And if you wanted to continue your education to 18, you needed to find a school with a sick form or a sick form college or something. So there was a natural kind of point in my education there where it was a question, well, what am I going to do? And I absolutely 100% wanted to go to a Quaker school. That's what I wanted.
Okay.
My mum would very seriously say to me, you do realize that Quaker school is not the same as this residential week that you do. It's a different thing, you know, but I absolutely wanted to. And so my grandmother agreed to pay for it. And I signed myself up. And well, I didn't sign myself up. My mum signed me up and off I went. Incidentally, my grandmother then forgot that she'd promised to pay for it and didn't. But
right.
But my mum very gracefully, you know, managed to make it work. So I went off to Quaker boarding school and it was amazing. It was two of the best years of my life. It was just utterly brilliant. And I met two very close friends who I still go on holiday with all the time. And we are, I don't know, I was going to say soulmates. I suppose, yeah, we are really. Like yeah. We know each other so well. And
yeah.
But also, whilst I was, as I said, I went at sixth form, but the school actually took much younger children.
Okay.
And I remember I was going to dinner one evening and there was this girl on the stairs and there was something about her. And I remember quite distinctly, and again, I'm going to go back to that nudge. I remember quite distinctly thinking, I wonder if we're going to get married. I'm probably playing it wrong in my head that like it wasn't the first time I'd seen her or it wasn't the first time, but quite. But after a year, we sort of got together, and we stayed together. She was 18 months younger than me.
Okay.
So which is sort of 2 years in two school years.
Okay.
So I went off to university and she stayed at school, and then we sort of followed each other around. But yeah, sure enough, we got married and we are still very happily married.
Very cool.
yeah, I think so. Yeah, so I have, the Quaker grandfather and Quaker mother and Quaker wife. And
yeah.
So there's quite a lot of Quakers in the family. But then I sort of started to settle in Norwich and I became a member of staff at that residential week that I mentioned.
Okay.
I did that into my sort of late 20s, early 30s. And then my wife, Verity, joined me and we were staff together. And I've skipped over the fact that we also got married.
It was implied.
Yeah, it was implied. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's when I had a break. I think when my second child was born, Verity and I felt we couldn't continue to do the residential week, and we stopped.
Okay.
And my son started going to the same residential week about 2 years ago, and he found his people and he loves it. And he, you know, because I used to write letters, he's on WhatsApp all the time, but he's made that connection. And he, after a year ago, when he came back, he said, right, I want to start going to meeting. I want to start going to meeting every Sunday. And I was like, well, I'm sure this is a fad, but I will absolutely support you in doing that. And him and I started going. And that was kind of when I started to come back. After having had a sort of break of 10-15 years. And so I have a minor role at my local meeting now, and you know, I go more regularly than my son, who, you know,
yeah,
he still goes, but he's possibly not as much as he originally intended. Yeah, so I'm sort of coming back into the fold, but there has never been a time when I wouldn't have considered myself a Quaker. There was never a time when I felt that I'd left the Society of Friends.
Okay.
I feel it really defines me and who I am. And the more I learned about Quakerism, the more I felt that it was right for me.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say, just to disambiguate, is that I come from the British liberal wing is the wrong word. There's a better word for it. Tradition. The British liberal tradition of Quakerism, which is quite similar to the East Coast in America tradition of Quakerism, but it is quite different from other Quaker groups, particularly in North America. There's like an evangelical tradition and a pastoral tradition and a conservative tradition, but conservative as in conserving the old ways, not as
correct.
In political alignment.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a lot of questions.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of things I want to say as well.
So. Yeah, cool. Can I ask just a couple and then I'll let you back on? So I had to look up whether or not the term Quaker was derogatory. Because correct me, obviously, if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
It is the Religious Society of Friends is actually what you refer to yourselves, correct?
Yeah, so we tend to use Quaker and a friend interchangeably, but outside of the society, we would often use Quaker to disambiguate, because friends is an ambiguous term,
sure,
but Quaker isn't.
Right.
But if I'm talking to someone else in the society, then I would tend to refer to them as a friend.
Okay. And then you've hinted at, you know, different branches.
Yeah.
You hinted about, like, with your grandfather as well, maybe being a little more, I don't know what the right term is there, conservative, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Would you say the tradition that you're a part of is more about the practice and community aspects than maybe just to set the context? As you probably know, most of the audience is going to be former evangelical, which is just a world away from Quakerism that we can play with a little bit here. Tell us just a little bit more about the practice as you experience it.
Yeah, so it's hard to write. So we have testimonies, and testimonies are things that Quakers generally believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be a theme. That's a theme of talking about all Quakerism, is that there is no doctrine. There is no one thing that you have to believe. And that is its strength and its curse. So in Britain, the testimonies are simplicity, peace, equality and truth.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of sustainability is coming up more in addition. Okay. And it's pretty much the same for in the US, although I think you transpose truth for integrity and add in community as well. But you will get general agreement among friends about the importance of those testimonies. I think simplicity is possibly the one that's least well defined.
Okay.
But simplicity, I think when you start with simplicity, you start thinking of it as a material possessions. Like, I'm not going to chase expensive cars. I'm not going to chase these sort of things. But it kind of, I'm not going to dress in some, you know, in extravagant clothes. But actually, it's kind of, it's almost more important that it's simplicity of expression. It's making your message clear and accessible to people. And I think not being complicated for the sake of it. That's, you know, not that, you know, some ideas just are complicated. Peace is about how we treat each other, mm-hmm. and how we speak to each other. So, you know, there are, you know, violent ways of speaking and violent ways of being. And I think, you know, Quakers generally would agree that, you know, we'll try and avoid anything of violence. And but it isn't easy. There are arguments for armies, there are arguments for peacekeeping forces, and it's grey. So I don't have a, you know, I don't have a great answer on a political level around how peace works. But what you can do is advocate for peace, and mm-hmm. you can advocate for diplomacy. So I think that the peace one is huge.
Yeah.
But I think the one that helps you understand Quakerism the best, I think, is the testimony to equality. Because from equality, you can kind of understand how Quakerism is structured, in that we have no pastors, no preachers, we have nobody who is in charge. Because for there to be that person, there would be an implication that that person was closer to God than anybody else, that that person was somehow more equal than the rest of us. And so that feeds into how we do business, how we get married, how we do funerals, what our meetings are like. It's all based on the fact that we are all equal in the eyes of God.
So no hierarchy. It's completely flat from equal participants.
Yeah. No hierarchy at all. Even to the point that I might get the wording slightly wrong, but there's a special amendment in law that allows us to get married because there's no one who marries us.
Okay.
So we have to, when my wife and I went to tell the local council that we were getting married and they were sorting up the marriage certificate, and they say, right, well, who is it that's getting you married? You have to say we're Quakers and there's no one, you know, there's no single.
Right.
And they have to enact a particular thing to allow us to do it.
I did not know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then the other testimony that I think is worth is the testimony to truth. And I think my son has some very strong feelings about this one, because he feels there are very legitimate reasons why you wouldn't tell the truth. I mean, for example, you know, if you were in an oppressive environment where being honest about who you are got you, you know, mistreated, then that'd be a good reason not to be truthful. And whereas I think with all these testimonies, you've got to take them in the spirit that they're intended. And I think for the testimony to truth or integrity is about, it's not trying to mislead people. And I think you've got to be careful, like, not to say lie, because it's not about lying. Mm-hmm. It's about, can't lie by omission, you can't lie by thing, and you've got to be, and it's, you know, it's being truthful to yourself as well being truthful to other people. And then there are some interesting there's some slightly older testimonies. So there's a testimony to dates and times, which isn't observed quite so much, but it's kind of, you will see it in meeting that we in theory don't acknowledge that Easter or Christmas is any more special than any other day.
I see.
Because the idea of that testimony from, I don't know, 100 plus years ago was, you know, every day is a gift. And the idea that one day is more of a gift than another it doesn't make sense.
Interesting.
Yeah. Going back to the equality testimony, that's one of the things that kind of does make you stand out as a Quaker, is try not to use titles, because titles imply a hierarchy. So... But in a domestic situation, like when I was growing up, mum and dad were titles. So I did refer to my mom as mum, but I also referred to her as Jenny, and I referred to my dad, did the same thing.
Okay.
And I stuck with it, with, you know, same thing with my children, and my eldest just always calls me dad, but my youngest, he does a really good impression of, or he always makes me think of Bart Simpson. You know, the way that Bart always refers to Homer as Homer.
Yes.
he has a really good way. He always calls me Liam. Uh-huh. And when we're out, it sounds like that's how it sounds in my ear, that he's kind of doing it in a slightly, I don't know.
That's amazing. Way, yeah. Kids are, what can you say?
Yeah. Yeah.
They keep you humble, let's just say.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that I am interested in is the fact that your father was a staunch atheist.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how that was like as you made your commitment to Quakerism, and then maybe even as an adult, what your relationship was like with your father.
Yeah. I'm afraid it's not a long thread. My father died when I was 17.
I'm sorry.
No, it was a while ago. And I felt his conviction for the peace movement, and I felt it overlapped with my conviction. So we had common ground, and we didn't talk about religion, really. Mm-hmm. He was respectful of my mum's belief, certainly in my earshot. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he was fairly neutral about me going to a Quaker school. I know when I was young and my parents were still together, he was less keen on me going to meeting. And I think my mum used to sort of go to meeting on the weekends that I was with him. Mm-hmm. So it was, I don't think we ever really discussed it explicitly, but I think he had a degree of contempt for religion, and I don't think that went away. But I also, I don't know, I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm sorry if I hit a sore spot there.
No, not at all.
Yeah. I definitely have more questions, but I feel like I've gotten you off your rhythm. Where else did you want to go with the story?
I think the other thing I wanted to say is, like, one of the other things that's important to know about Quakers is that we have things called dual membership and triple membership, which is where you can be a Quaker and another faith.
Interesting.
So we have Buddhist Quakers and Anglican Quakers. Triple membership's pretty unusual, but double membership is becoming increasingly frequent. And the other thing that is, I would say, definitely unusual is that we have a fairly large contingent of atheist Quakers, agnostic Quakers, and non-theist Quakers.
That was going to be one of my questions. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought up the topic.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, yes, I should have said, you might know this, but meeting consists of going to the meeting house and sitting in silence for an hour. And the idea is that if the spirit moves you to speak, you speak. Mm. But certainly in the British liberal tradition, we don't have programmed ministry. So you're not supposed to decide what you're going to do beforehand. You have to wait for that in the meeting. But that means that you're there for a kind of an hour with your own thoughts. And we have ministry from atheist friends, mm-hmm. but we also have ministry from traditional sort of Christian background friends who will read from the Bible. And it makes for an interesting kind of experience, because one of the sort of principles that we try and hold to is to try and see the inner kind of light of what somebody's saying. Mm-hmm. So I kind of bring that up because I've talked about God and I've talked as if, but actually to me, part of my Quaker journey was to get past those words.
Okay.
because when I was growing up, I found them very difficult. I didn't want to be really talking about God, and I didn't, because I felt strongly that I didn't believe in an omnipresent being.
Okay.
And so I didn't like the word, but I think part of my journey has been to make peace with that word and to make peace with what people mean when they talk about it. And I appreciate that in Quakerism, that's different to if I was talking to maybe somebody from a Catholic tradition where the interpretation is much more kind of more literal. But in Quakerism, even when people are quoting from the Bible, they're usually trying to explain or exhibit a behavior that we as Quakers should aspire to.
Okay.
And I think that's how I sort of get around the language.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to dig in here. Like, this is the part that really fascinates me.
Yeah.
Do you connect with the term non-theist? Is that something that you think describes you?
No, not really. So there's another famous sort of Quaker thing, which is called that of God in every man. And the idea is that everybody is fundamentally good. I think of that goodness as God.
Okay.
And it is just in some ways it's a label, but I think to believe that everybody is good involves a degree of spiritualness.
Yeah.
Because it would be easy not to believe that.
All evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I don't really align with the non-theist thing, because I feel like it would somehow take away part of that belief.
I'm definitely reminded of a chat that we had probably the 2014, 2015 timeframe, when I was, I think, just months away from my change of opinion. And we had a very similar conversation to what we're having now. And the thing that I was struck by then, and I'm remembering, is how radically different your faith is from evangelicalism. I mean, it's kind of polar opposites in some ways. I was having to learn what it meant for you, as what you've just described, that you use the term God to describe the goodness of humanity. And, you know, again, maybe the audience is having the same questions, what does that mean to you, and how does that, I don't know, just expand on it more.
Well, I think this is when I think I said earlier about Quakerism being brilliant and difficult simultaneously. And I think this is one of the things I really, really, a big part of me wants someone to tell me what to believe and what's right.
Mm.
And Quakerism just does not do that for you. And it's hard, because so much of it is finding your own way. It would be nice to be able to speak to somebody and say, I don't know what to think about this, and have them tell you. And also, sometimes it's hard being in something that's so difficult to nail down.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in my 20s, someone saying to me, if Quakerism was made illegal tomorrow, would there be enough evidence to convict you? And I was like, I'm honestly not sure. And I think a lot of Quakers have that experience, that it's because so little of it is prescriptive.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think I feel like this is going to come across as high and mighty, and I don't mean it like that. But I think constantly having to question what you believe and what you think never lets you off the hook. So you're always being challenged in your behavior and how you approach things, and in terms of, you know, your relationship with God. I mean, even the when I say it like that, your relationship with God.
Yeah, just to be clear, for evangelicals, that has layers and layers of meaning that probably isn't applicable in the way that you're using it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's probably completely the wrong phrase for most people. But it's like my understanding of what God is and what God is to me And I think that's, I think I should also say that I have very little knowledge of the way that other religions work, and I have very little knowledge of how secular things work. I've always been a Quaker. And one of my concerns almost when talking to you was that, like, somebody would say, well, you're obviously not a Quaker, you're something else, you know. but I am, you know, but I stand by my Quakerism.
Yes.
But yeah, going back to the doubt of God in every man, I think where I was going with the challenging thing is it isn't an easy thing to believe, but it's very easy to dehumanize people that you disagree with. And it's very easy to dehumanize people who do horrific things. And I don't think that gets us anywhere. I think we have to start with the idea that everybody is good and that everybody's human and that everybody is fallible, and that things that lead people to do bad, you know, to act in a bad way, that there are reasons why people do that. There are some, you know, often the worst actors have the most challenging kind of backstories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like that was definitely a challenge for me, like bringing up my children. Like, they'd come home and say, this kid was horrible to me. And you'd be like, well, you know, they probably, you know, there's probably a lot else going on that you don't know. And that is not what a child wants to hear. And, you know, it's probably entirely the wrong thing to say because they took no notice. But, you know, it's trying to kind of instill that idea that everyone has a background and context and what have you, that you have to try and look past.
One of the topics that I want to talk about is how, especially the way that you describe your Quakerism, is so close to what I refer to as secular grace. So the only difference is that I don't have a spiritual spin on it. I'm saying that we need to recognize the humanity in others. We need to accept our own humanity, which includes both our goodness and our fallibility, and the same for others, and showing respect and kindness to people. And so the way you describe things strikes me as we're on the other side of the fence, shaking hands with each other. You know, we're very, very close.
Yeah. Almost like that might be why we were friends. We've been friends.
Yes,
the same
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, completely. And I can see that, but I say, as if I'm saying, but there's something that divides us. I don't think there is. I wasn't going to try and insert that.
Here's what I would say is that you are describing a much more disciplined view of the world than what I am describing. So, like, you know, having the discussion with your child about that's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
The attitude that he ought to have to somebody who's been negative toward him, that's much more disciplined than what I am describing. So that's a definite difference.
Yeah. The only thing I would say, though, again, is like again, with Quakerism, it's difficult because you sort of always have to talk in broad strokes. Like, I think most Quakers would do that, you know, like most Quakers. But obviously there are exceptions. I find the structure very, very helpful. And I find the community very helpful in that there's somewhere that I can go and I can meet like-minded people who view the world like I do. And, you know, Quakers aren't passive. In my meeting, it's not unusual for us to talk about who was arrested over the past sort of few weeks, or, you know, who's at what a demonstration or rally. I tend to think of it as being like the older friends who perhaps being arrested doesn't impact their employment prospects in quite the same way, but they are a very active community. And we had one of the members of our meeting was demonstrating against outside an American airbase. There's a sort of 100 about 50 odd miles south of where I am. So, yeah, and I like being surrounded by these people.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of them are better humanists than I am. You know, a lot of them are, when I say humanists, I don't know that I'm using the word correctly, but a lot of them are better at the way that they reach out to other humans.
Yeah, I want to jump on that. So I think, and definitely going through this change of mind for myself, that there is a religious humanism and a secular humanism, and they are very, very, very close to one another.
Yeah.
Similar to what we were saying earlier. And so I think humanism is a great way of describing what you are talking about for Quakerism.
Great. Thank you. I am more active in the society than my wife is, but on a day-to-day basis, my wife is the person helping the guy in the street. My wife is the person, she's much better at it. And I think that's part of, like, you know, going to meet and going, being a friend is a lot of people to kind of aspire to be better at this stuff. And I think I have a tendency to sort of, you know, because I work from home, I have a tendency to sort of look inward a lot. And I think it helps me sort of broaden my horizons. And also sitting for an hour in silence, I can imagine some people really not liking the idea of that, but it's incredible. For me, it's so, so helpful. I used to, when I was younger, I would sit, you know, when I was in my sort of teens and 20s, I would go and sit down, and it was like my brain was on fire. Mm. Like there would be just thoughts just constantly going. And after an hour, it would have all calmed down and I'd be in a much better place. But now I go to meeting in a much more, I tend to do it in a much more sort of structured way. I don't feel like that anymore. But it gives me an opportunity to, like, think about how I've lived my life in the last few weeks or week. And we have this idea in Quakerism of holding people in the light. And I think normally people would say pray for, but we don't say pray for, we say hold them in the light. And it's just almost to think of them in a positive, you know, way. Not because we think positive thinking is going to heal them, but because it's about, for me, it's about thinking about them and about thinking if there's anything you can do, or it's just about thinking about them so that you'll have that context when they come back into meeting, you know, if for some reason they can't attend. But I find that a really useful time to do. I do that for the people around me. And I'll think about the people, you know, I'll think about my wife and my children and whoever, and have that time to think, what am I missing? Like, what should I be doing that I'm not doing? And I sort of have that first part of meeting. And then the second part, I tend to have my eyes closed throughout meeting because I find I get distracted by shoelaces, chairs, you know, things. But we had a Quaker Buddhist was talking about his experience of being in a Quaker meeting versus meditating. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that for him, meditating is an inward, you look inwards. Meditation is about, like, listening to your body, what's it doing, feeling your breath, feeling, you know, trying to locate your feelings and what have you. And being in a Quaker meeting is an outward stillness. And I think that put it really, really well. That's how I feel about it, is that it isn't an inward hour, it's an outward hour where we're all in this community, we're all in this room together in silence. And it's, you know, I gain a lot of strength from it, and a lot of that sense again of being part of, you know, something better than I am, something bigger. And the one thing that I think is kind of interesting, and I found sometimes difficult in my adult life, is the Quaker way of doing business. I really like, and to me, it's a good model for doing business, which is again, we don't vote. So we don't have, I don't mean we don't vote in government elections. Right, I mean, right, we don't vote internally.
For polity issues.
Yeah. We look for consensus in the group. And the idea there is that we don't leave people ostracized or left out by decision or whatever. So if we've got a contentious issue that we need to discuss, the way that we do it is we, if you have something to say, you will stand up and say it and sit down. And then we leave a respectful silence, or we should, of a minute or two. And then you stand up and someone else stand up. And the idea is you don't try not to repeat what other people have said, and to a certain extent, try not to just say, I agree with that guy. And then at the end of it, the clerks write a minute, which to reflect the feeling of the meeting and the way forward. Then we as a meeting agree whether that minute reflects, we feel that that minute reflects what we've discussed. Mm-hmm. There was something else I wanted to mention, which it's Quaker weddings and funerals, because I think they are in some ways they epitomize what Quakerism is like. So when you get married in I had a Quaker wedding. When you get married, everybody comes in silence and you all sit in a circle, and it's held exactly like any meeting. But you sit with your intended. Mm-hmm. In the kind of inner circle. You don't have to, but that tends to be where you sit.
Right.
And people stand up. Your friends stand up. Your parents stand up. And they talk about how they feel about it and how their memories of you. And there's no one who's met you for the first time standing in front of you reciting stories back to you or your family.
Right.
And it's so touching. And at the end, everybody at that meeting signs your wedding certificate. So I'm looking at my wedding certificate over there, and it's got 120 signatures on it, because it's the responsibility of all those 120 people to uphold our marriage. It's not the responsibility of a single pastor or whoever at the front. It's all of your responsibility. And it's incredibly moving. And then Quaker funerals are the same. And I went to my father-in-law's funeral at the beginning of last year, and the meeting house was packed, like standing room at the back, mm-hmm. of a lifetime of people that this man had met and affected the lives of. And again, it's a meeting held in the normal Quaker style, and it was an hour of people talking about what he was like in the schoolyard, what he was like when he was, had this job, what he was like when he was retired, and those stories that you would never, as his widow or his children, they would never hear those stories in any other way. And it was the most beautiful celebration of that man. And I think that comes from Quakers' equality testimony. I've been to some, one or two humanist kind of mm-hmm. services, and I expect you could do that if you wanted to. There'd be nothing stopping you arranging it like that. But that is how it's arranged in Quakerism, and it's magical. I mean, really deeply moving.
It sounds beautiful. Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
We lost my father-in-law 2 or 3 years ago, and there was a bit of a formal service, but we had something similar, not quite as egalitarian.
Yeah.
There was an actual microphone up at the top, but like people did come up and tell stories. And I think that's a really important part of the grieving process.
Absolutely.
Another few things that just stand out, the experience, particularly for people who were evangelicals and who lose their faith. One of the major things on the other side of that is the loss of community.
Yeah.
So not only have you lost what felt like your best friend
yeah.
And purpose, it's not that you lose purpose, but rather a handed out purpose, hand given, you also lose the people.
Yeah.
You've said a number of things. You've talked about finding your people, having soulmate level friends, the collective aspect of worship for you that, yeah. that is so meaningful. I can assure you that those are the things that we miss.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of different believers on the show. I think this might be the first episode where there might be some people that convert to Quakerism, and I can assure you that's never happened before.
Well, it's funny you should say it, but we have refugees from other religions. Mm-hmm. If that's not too loaded a term,
Well, I think it's an accurate one. But, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There was a point where I think we had three or four Anglican priests in our meeting, and it's either for some of them it was like, certainly for one of them it was a crisis of faith, mm-hmm. that brought him, and he's returned. But other people it's not, you know, it's part of a transition, and I think that's one of, you know, Quakerism's strengths, is that it's such a broad church in terms of what you believe, because you don't have to believe any one thing.
Right.
And funnily enough, when I was thinking about coming on here, it made me realize how little I know about my mum's faith. Mm. Like, for me, I don't believe in the resurrection, but I wondered whether, like, she does. And it made me think I really ought to at least understand that.
Right.
But yeah, I think people join Quakers from an atheist background or non-theist, agnostic, whatever background, because they are attracted by a lot of the structure, you know, without the requirement for
the dogma. Yeah.
Yeah, for the dogma.
Yeah. Let me give you an example of how literal we are as evangelicals and former evangelicals. You know, just that statement of, do you believe in the resurrection or not, is literally binary.
Yeah.
And was so for me, right?
Yeah.
The minute that I kind of admitted to myself, I don't think the resurrection occurred.
Yeah.
I mean, boom, 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 boom. It's like all the dominoes fell.
Yeah.
And I was out. Again, I can't express to you the difference in orientation between evangelicalism and what you are describing.
Yeah, I've been in Quakerism for so long that I forget, like I don't, but yeah, to me like Quakerism makes sense, and I don't understand why we aren't building new meeting houses because everybody wants to be a Quaker, but yes. But you know, we're slowly contracting like most.
Well, Liam, this has lived up to every expectation that I had. I think you are genuinely a beautiful human being, and the care for humanity and the discipline with which you practice your faith is truly beautiful, coming from an atheist.
Right? Thank you so much. That's so kind.
So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
I've had a great time. Thank you so much for having me.
Final thoughts on the episode. I think you could hear almost my own nervousness interviewing Liam. One of the reasons I have wanted to do these kinds of interviews with people who I know and love and care about, who happen to have faith, is that the stakes are higher. I care what Liam thinks. I think that it was also true that Liam cared what I thought. I want to repeat that Liam shouldn't have to feel like he is representing all of Quakerism or British liberal Quakerism. We are interested in his story, how it impacted his life, how it has helped him in his life. And I respect Liam specifically so much. So his dedication and the discipline with which he practices his spiritual beliefs is admirable. A few things that really leapt out at me. He talked about finding his people. He talked about having soulmate friends, which I just thought was such a beautiful way of saying that. The community that he describes, and coming together, process of marriage, the process of funerals, the equality that goes all the way to there being no leader in those meetings. All of that, I think, was just beautiful. And I was not kidding when I said probably there will be some of the listeners who are drawn to that. I can absolutely say what we are missing on this side of deconstruction and deconversion is that community. And if that community can come without dogma, without a set of required beliefs, that is very attractive. Another thing that stood out to me, though, was Liam's discomfort at the term God. And he says that he came to terms with that. He came to terms with what people meant by it. You've heard me say many times that I think the most dangerous word in the English language is God. And what I mean by that is when you use that term, literally every individual beyond just every group has a different interpretation of what that means. So I share that discomfort with the term, but I appreciate what Liam's definition is, the goodness of humanity. And we joked, all evidence to the contrary. And believing in that and believing in human beings and their dignity is so close to secular grace. I am absolutely amazed. Liam, thank you so much for being on the podcast and for sharing your graceful life philosophy and your spiritual discipline. It was an incredibly meaningful conversation. I hope you and I have more on or off the mic. And I think you will have made an impression on this audience. So thank you so much. The Secular Grace Thought of the Week is absolutely inspired by Liam. I want to quote him here. I think we have to start with the idea that everybody is good and that everybody is human and that everybody is fallible. I have probably said those words, maybe not in that exact order, hundreds of times. What secular grace is, what humanism means to me, is embracing our own humanity, which includes our own fallibility, embracing the humanity of others, recognizing the humanity, dignity, the human rights of others, and ultimately seeing the good in them. I think that's maybe where there's the tiniest daylight between us, in that I don't necessarily see things in terms of good and evil, but rather humanity and lack of humanity. We as a species are fully capable of doing atrocious things, of being evil towards one another, and we are also capable of loving kindness, caring, and being altruistic. That is the terrifying and beautiful thing about being a human being, is that we are capable of all of that. I really have come to understand that we in the deconstruction world should embrace religious humanists, people who are still within a religious framework, but whose humanism comes out and is acted upon. Those are our allies, and we should be working alongside them. I know many of the volunteer opportunities, at least here in the United States, to say work in a place to feed the homeless or do good in the world often comes along with a religious organization, and we should not be scared of participating in those things. We can be the atheist in the middle because of shared values. Another aspect of secular grace is recognizing our shared values, and when we value other human beings collectively, together, that's the most powerful thing in the universe. Until next time, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. If you want to get in touch with me to be a guest on the show, email me at gracefulatheist@gmail.com. For blog posts, quotes, recommendations, and full episode transcripts, head over to gracefulatheist.com. This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. This is David. Check out my new podcast, Certainly Dubious, with my very good friend Mark Diaz. where two longtime friends take on the intriguing and the bizarre with opposing viewpoints. We invite you to listen and pick a side. Mark, the open-minded, and David, the skeptic. Join us and pick a side.